It is some years since we discussed Kurrendak Station in Victoria, which has some significance, great significance in Aboriginal history. And I'm delighted to return to it tonight. And we're going to look at the story from a very different vantage point. It was a model farm built in 1863 by the displaced Kulin people, making them self-sufficient, economically independent. But by 1877, the land had significantly increased in value, and the surrounding farmers and the notorious Board for the Protection of Aborigines decided they wanted to take it over for themselves. Now, with the threat of being displaced again, the men and women began a protest that included petitions and letter writing. In fact, their lobbying triggered a parliamentary inquiry in 1881, making it one of the first sustained campaigns for justice, land rights and self-determination in colonial Australia. And surprise, surprise, it didn't have a happy ending. Now, the story has been developed into verbatim theatre, and I want to discuss this with its co-authors, Giordano Nanni and Andrea James. Giordano, first of all, verbatim theatre is, I guess, exactly what it says. It's the reading of official documents.
Ah, yes, that's right. Verbatim theatre, or in this case, also known as tribunal theatre, where specifically the documents come from judicial proceedings. And it's quite a rich tradition. Quite a few famous trials have been reenacted, like the Nuremberg trials, the Hutton Inquiry in England. But Kurrendak, this play that we've been working on, is very different in that regard, because it brings back to life an inquiry that very few people know about. It's not a well-known event, and so it's bringing it back into the public sphere.
The voice of Giordano Nanni, his fellow at the University of Melbourne, he's in our Melbourne TARDIS. Andrea James is artistic associate at Carriage Works and is in the Sydney studio. Andrea, tell us about your involvement, because as a Yorta Yorta woman, it's also a personal journey for you.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I met Giordano, I guess, about 4 years ago this journey began, but of course it began a lot earlier, as he was reading the minutes of evidence as an historian and contemplating all of the evidence and the characters and thinking about it being a theatricalisation. So I was working at the Koori Heritage Trust at the time as a community arts worker. So I met Giordano at that time, and he started talking about these extraordinary transcripts and the possibility of them being theatricalised and reenacted again. So I guess that's where our creative journey began.
Giordano, there were similar struggles taking place at other Victorian reserves. So what was it that distinguished this struggle?
Oh, that's a very good question, and it's really important for us to remember that other struggles just as powerful and long-lasting took place at Framlingham, Lake Conder, Lake Tyres, later at Cummeragunja. I guess what distinguished Kurrendak is that it was the success of the campaign there, was that the people under William Barak, the women and men of Kurrendak, waged their campaign very publicly. They managed to get their voices into the press. They managed to, first of all, they were close to Melbourne. Kurrendak was only about 60 kilometres from Melbourne, whereas most of the other reserves and missions were too long to walk. So the men and women could form deputations. And then, of course, they got their words into the inquiry, which was unprecedented. No other protest had resulted in such, had mobilised such political force to create that kind of response.
Well, the last time we talked about it was when Barack Obama was surfacing. And, of course, one couldn't help but point out the fascinating similarity of the names, yeah, of William Barack. But also the fact that he was a charismatic leader and clearly a very good person.
Absolutely. Andrea, do you want to jump in here? I think
Yeah, well, yeah. We talk about William Barak. I mean, culturally, he was known as Narangita, a spokesman, a spokesperson, a very, very important man culturally, you know, for the Kulin and the Wurundjeri. He was an extraordinary looking man, and he also had a great gift and talent for painting. And you know, in the last 20 years of his life, he painted these extraordinary paintings, which can still be seen today. One of them is exhibited at the moment in London, in the Australia exhibition, Barak's painting of corroborees. And you know, it was this extraordinary time. These last 20 years, it was this. He had this burning desire to paint what he saw as a child, these really important ceremonies. So he's left this incredible, incredible legacy, not only within the letters and all of the petitions in which he, you know, led his people. Many times they walked from Corindirk to Melbourne to go straight to the heads of parliament to protest against the treatment, but also to lobby for land rights.
And, of course, as I remember, often turned away, ignored.
Yeah.
And having to be absolutely insistent and patient and resolute. But, of course, that reminds us that the clans who established the station in 1863, you describe as true survivors. Why?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, this is one of the harrowing things that you see in the transcripts themselves, where they actually say, you know, how many Aboriginal people are left in Victoria? And they said about 1,000, you know, and we know that, you know, before the whitefellas arrived, there was, you know, 60,000 people. So, you know, really, these people were absolutely struggling for survival. You know, to think about my people, the Yorta Yorta people, there were really only 300 people left at that time. I mean, it's extraordinary. And I guess that's what's just so wonderful about this project, that, you know, I'm collaborating with Giordano. I'm a descendant of one of the people that are witnesses within that, the transcripts, Alec Campbell. And, you know, I guess we've survived. We survived this really harrowing time. And, you know, I guess, you know, Barak and the people were determined to stay on country and to just build up strength as people again.
Sure, Donna, they had a couple of pretty useful white friends, and I'm thinking, of course, of John Green and his wife Mary. John, a Scottish Presbyterian lay preacher, who was instrumental in helping establish that community.
Absolutely. In many ways, this at the heart of Corindirk's success was this collaboration between white and black, which is probably another distinguishing feature between Corindirk and the other reserves. There just wasn't that kind of relationship. It was for the time, it was really quite an egalitarian relationship. In one of the parts of the inquiry, John Green is asked, did you ever have to call the police? How did you manage to manage the blacks, to use the words of the time? And he responds, I always treated them as free men and reasoned with them. I made a law with their own sanction and also fined some of them for drinking. But that was the Aboriginal law, that if any got drunk, they were fined. They were fined and some of them were chastised according to their own law. If the Aboriginal is put into the question, he says, he will strive to keep his own law. That is where I consider you have failed. And then at another point, he's asked whether mixing the blood improves the intelligence of our Aboriginal people. And of course, at that time, the standard answer to that would have been yes. And he flatly replies no. So he was, you know, he was quite an unusual character, but it really reminds us that back then there were white fellas who did the right thing, who stood up for what was right. It wasn't just a case of, you know, everyone was thinking alike. Then, as now, there were people who stood out.
But of course, that made him a target, and the government moves to remove him, doesn't it? The board orchestrates his removal.
Exactly, yeah. Precisely that level of collaboration that exists between white and black doesn't really suit certain power interests, which are more interested in divide-and-conquer approaches. And when the Board for the Protection of Aborigines, which is essentially hijacked by the local squatter pastoralist establishment via people like Edward Kerr, they see him as a problem, because they try to convince him to move the Aboriginal people, and he says, Again, this is verbatim. I know that I could move them because I can talk to them as men and as brothers, but I will not try, decidedly not.
Andrea, let's look at Edward Kerr, well named, a senior member of the Board for the Protection of Aborigines, self-appointed expert on matters Aboriginal, but he had, bugger all understanding of Aboriginal culture.
Well, yes, and it was, it was rather satisfying as a theatre maker to return to this particular historical figure again, because in an earlier play that I wrote, Yanagai Yanagai, about the Yorta Yorta native title claim, of course we encountered Kerr, and he was one of the first white men to come in and settle on Yorta Yorta country, and he later wrote his recollections of squatting in Victoria, and he really was known at the time or considered as an expert on Aboriginal people, and in fact those recollections of squatting in Victoria was used as evidence against the Yorta Yorta people as well.
Let me clarify this. Recollections of Squatting in Victoria,
yes,
was his memoir.
Yes, that's right, which was written some, 50 years or more, from his contact then as well. So, they were literally recollections, but they were taken as quite gospel in the native title claim.
Any redeeming features, Andrea?
Of Kerr?
Yeah.
Oh, well, he was on the Aborigines Protections Board, but ultimately he had vested interests. I mean, his family had massive land holdings. I think they began in Tasmania. They had land holdings in Ballarat as well, and then of course they went up to really conquer that area on my father's homelands around Cummeragunga on Yorta Yorta country. So, the interests were absolutely vested. He wanted to have as much land, and he was capitalising off our land, and yet here he was on the Aborigines Protection Board encouraging the Corindirk people to be moved off so that white people could go in and take over the land. I mean, it's incredibly fertile land right on the river there. Perfect, and
if I could just jump in, there's a really another important point that Andrew, of course, is very familiar with, is that Edward Kerr's recollections of squatting of Victoria was then used only recently in 2000 by High Court Justice Howard Olney as evidence in the Yorta Yorta native title claim. So even though Edward Kerr died back in the 1890s, his words continue to have an impact on the descendants of the Yorta Yorta. And of course, Andrew James can probably talk more authoritatively about this, as she even made a play about this this very incident. But Edward Kerr, in a sense, continues to talk today in our courts. And those that have followed the case know that in the end, Justice Olney upheld or denied the Yorta Yorta native claim based largely on the evidence of Edward Kerr.
Keith Windschuttle would love this story because, of course, he's a great believer in the written record as opposed to oral traditions. Andrea, let's look at a couple of other prominent characters. Tell us about the widow of Wappen.
Oh, Anne Bonn, what an extraordinary, amazing woman. And, I mean, she was quite a remarkable woman from her time. I mean, she married a much older man who I understand was going to propose to her mother and then her sister, and so she ended up taking up the offer, and luckily she did, because he was a very well off man, and they had large land holdings on Wappen, and a lot of Aboriginal people would come and shear sheep, and that's where she developed relationships with Aboriginal people and a lot of concern. And of course, when her husband died, she inherited all of this land and quite a lot of wealth. And she had a home in Kew. She was quite an established woman and very, very influential and very outspoken. And she developed an incredible relationship with William Barrack as well, and really advocated for the people. She could see, she could see what was going on. She could see and understand the machinations that was going on with the Aborigines Protection Board. She was very dissatisfied with what was going on and, really lobbied, got the people, a doorway into the the powers that be. And also she was very clever in lobbying, you know, the newspapers of the time as well, and reporting things in the Argus and writing letters as well, and really agitating. In fact, I think Strickland, the manager of Corranderk at one stage, called her a wicked woman. You know, she was very outspoken and incredibly so for the time that she was speaking in as well.
Tell us about Thomas Dunbally, who was only 25 when he testified.
Yeah, he was a really interesting man, and you know, I think what's so interesting about Corranderk is that the young people that came through, they took up writing skills, and so really, you know, William Barrack and Simon Wonga, you know, English was their second language. And so Thomas Dunbally was very important in that he was getting down the words. You know, literally Barrack was reciting to him or saying what we need to say to the white fellas, and he was writing it down in English. So he was a really important conduit for the older people, for the elders, a representative for the elders.
You know, when I first became aware of this story, you know, 20 years ago, I guess, I was dumbfounded, gobsmacked, that we didn't know about it, that it had evaporated from written history. It's not a part of the school curriculum, for example, is it, Giordano?
No, it's not, and that's exactly where we hope this project will really work one of its most important functions. I had, Philip, I had exactly the same reaction as you. I was born in Italy, and I came out to Melbourne early about 11 years ago, and I learned about the story almost immediately after I came, and I assumed, because it is such an incredible story, I assumed that everyone would know about it. And literally when I realized how little known it was, it really, first it shocked me, and then it seemed like a real injustice. And I think that that's what's really driven not only me, but everyone that's come on board this project and has worked so hard, has really been motivated by the sense that this story just needs to be better known. And one of the ways in which we're doing this is through a project that's called the Minutes of Evidence Project, which is as quite a large project fund, and it's been funded by the Australian Research Council, the ARC, and it includes the University of Melbourne, the Department of Education, Arts Victoria, Ilbidgery Theatre Company, which of course has played a key role in all of this by putting on the performance. They're the oldest Aboriginal theatre company in the country. And Rachel Mazza and Isaac Drandage, who have directed the performances, have been crucial. So have La Mama Theatre and various other partners.
It's wonderfully credentialed, isn't it?
It is.
And very eclectic in its connections.
We really hope at the moment what's happening is the Department of Education is preparing curriculum that will accompany the play and really help to help teachers to use the play as an educational tool. I mean, theatre is just so engaging. It's such a great way of engaging with kids, and kids know so well. They can spot unfairness and injustice so quickly. We really hope they'll engage with this story and through theatre, and really make a change so that people do grow up knowing about the story.
Let's circling back to the notion of verbatim theatre, Andrea. It's you know, to the untrained ear, it sounds easy. You just read bits out, but it'd be rather like turning a couple of volumes of Hansard into a mini series. How did you do it?
Oh my God! You know, look, it was an extraordinary process, and the transcripts are very, you know, they're very lengthy. There are a lot of witnesses, but you know, ultimately, I think Giordano and I, you know, that the real characters and the real plots and subplots that were coming out were actually quite obvious in the end, and so it was really a case of going, oh gosh, that's an interesting story, and I can see and hear that on the stage, and you know, and drawing them out. We did order things around to, you know, to kind of get a sense of climax, and to, you know, I mean, because the challenge was ultimately in a inquiry like this, it's just question answer, but really the beauty of it is that the audience don't know what character is going to come up next, and you know, as eclectic as all of those stakeholders are in this particular project, as were the witnesses, you know, so many varied witnesses, and each one came at it from a different angle. So it was just a fascinating process.
Andrea, I take it that the cast members have to double, triple, quadruple up to fill out the characters.
They do, and it's beautiful to see, and audience members really enjoy that as well. You know, as you say, the doubling and tripling of characters, and the next version that's about to open next week at Belvoir, it's an all Aboriginal cast this time, and they Aboriginal actors will be playing non-Aboriginal actors, and I think there's been this real
joy. That is absolutely outrageous.
It is, isn't it?
Heavens above, we had a proud tradition of white actors playing Aborigines. Now you're turning the tables?
Well, we are trying to take over the world, as you know.
you and the Jesuits, yes. How does the stage look?
Oh, well, you know what? I haven't seen it yet. We're going to see a run tomorrow. So, I don't know. I don't know what they're cooking up as yet. They're going to keep it pretty simple. They've got a screen that comes in and out. So it's a bit of a postmodern approach for this next.
Well, I love the sound of it. I just think it's terrific. Mm. And of course, Giordano, there are so many other stories which are available for telling through the same creative methodology.
That's right. I mean, one of the beauties of this is that one of the ironies as well is that this evidence was collected by the Empire, and they were very efficient at collecting evidence. So there are minutes of evidence of colonial inquiries scattered around the world which could be used in a similar way. And one of the beautiful things about this is that the colonizers' archive is being redeployed to, reveal the injustice of colonialism, whereas originally was used perhaps to justify. Now it's used more to expose. And it's really, I mean, I think one of the other powerful things about people hearing these words is that they get direct access to this historical evidence, and they get to really have a go at interpreting it for themselves. We bypass the Keith Windschuttle history war thing and just go, well, you have direct access to these words and
Who plays Keith Windschuttle in the production? I love the thought of him being played by an Aboriginal actor.
That's a great idea.
Look, thank you. Thank you both. Giordano Nanni, Andrea James, authors of Cotton Deck, We Will Show the Country. Oh, it's published by Aboriginal Studies Press. Performance held at Belvoir from December 7th to January 4th.